From the Sky News Centre at 5, Cologne's police chief is reported to have been removed from his job. It follows fierce criticism of how the force, led by Wolfgang Albers, handled New Year's Eve violence in the city. More than 120 women have complained about being sexually assaulted or robbed by gangs of men. Tom Barfield's a journalist in Germany.
What seemed to have happened this afternoon is he's completely lost the support of the city mayor, Henriette Rieker, who has said that she believes the police were hiding information from her about what exactly happened on New Year's Eve. She said her trust in the police force was severely shaken and that she couldn't keep working with Albers.
Hospitals across the UK have issued black alerts due to immense pressure. Some have turned patients away from A&E, with others cancelling operations. But figures out today show there has been an overall improvement in waiting times in A&E departments. President of the Royal College of Emergency Medicine, Clifford Mann, insists it's not all bad news.
Well, I think it shows that we are under huge pressure. The figures that we've got for the last 5 weeks actually show that the system has performed substantially better than the winter of 2014-15. And last week it was 6% better. Fewer patients were in an A&E department beyond 4 hours compared with the same week last year.
Army bosses have been criticised for failing to stop a soldier getting a beasting. 22-year-old Private Gavin Williams died from heatstroke in 2006. He'd been ordered to do the intense but unofficial physical punishment for drunkenness and disobedience. A teenager's denied the murder of a police officer on Merseyside. PC Dave Phillips was hit by a stolen car he was trying to stop in Wallasey last October. The BNP has been removed from the register of political parties because it's failed to submit details to the Electoral Commission. It means it's been stripped of the right to field candidates in elections. And the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge will be going on an official trip to the remote South Asian nation of Bhutan in the spring. Prince Harry will visit Nepal to see the work done following the earthquake. That's the latest. I'm Kevin Gover.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Yes, we're back for 2016. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Councillor for Cabot Ward and the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Annie Stafford Townsend. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Grenville Johnson, Fabian Breckles join us, both from Ron Stone's area of St George, to pay tribute to the life and work of the Councillor Stone, who died unexpectedly while in the BRI for tests over the holiday. Councillor Stone was Labour's spokesman on housing and seemed to be one of the few politicians in the city to make genuine efforts and actions to tackle the housing racket, seeing it as a basic job of the council to see every Bristolian has somewhere decent to live. Plus, further afield, North Korea explode their first H-bomb, though Western governments are trying to throw doubt on it. But where did Phnom Penh get the uranium or plutonium bits from? Martin Summers has his theories. And the Turkish president sticks his foot in his mouth by discussing Hitler's Germany in public as if it were a good system of government. And over in Oregon, militias take over offices of a national park. Who are these militia gun lobby people, and is it their land? The Native Americans say no. Plus Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots over the last 3 weeks. That's all in the second hour. After six, on to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight lows of 5 Celsius, but heavy showers from the early hours on. This weekend highs of 10 Celsius, wet and windy. Next week highs of 8, plenty of wet and windy weather with some sunny spells. Next weekend, the 16th and 17th of January, there's highs of 7 Celsius, wet and windy and sunny spells too. Seems almost like April weather. How bizarre. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Councillor for Cabot Ward, leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Annie Stafford Townsend. Hi, Annie. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about your experience so far as leader of the Green Group.
Oh, well, I've only been leader since the beginning of December, so it's still very new to me. We're doing some interesting things at the moment. We've got the budget coming up soon, so we've got lots of negotiation and trying to do the best we can for Bristol in terms of sort of mitigating the cuts as best we can, negotiating good things for the vulnerable as best as we can with a cuts budget.
Now, well, you've got something like, I think, and I always roughly, I don't know, maybe you can help me on this, it's about £350 million of our money you spend every year. That's around about a grand per person in the city, something like that anyway. And I'm increasingly feeling, well, we pay our council tax, but what are we getting in return from it? Everything seems to be closing down, whether it's you know, care for elderly people, that seems to be being cut back. Everything else seems to be being cut back too. So what are we paying for?
We've actually had, I think it's going to be something like 75% of the budget to local authorities has been cut by central government by the time we're done with all of this. So it feels like £1,000 is a lot of money for people, but that covers, it covers the bins, it covers schools, it covers libraries, it covers all of the basic things, as well as the more important kind of community engagement things like libraries and schools. It covers the roads. It doesn't go very far, unfortunately, and that's why, because we're having central government cuts, things are having to be cut
back. It's easy to blame Westminster, isn't it? What, you know,
well,
you can't,
because
can't
that's
just
where
that.
Because it's true. That's, it's not taking an easy way out. It's just stating the truth.
Okay, what would you like to see? I mean, if the Greens were in power, actually, if you had your say on, I mean, how would you be doing differently from George Ferguson?
In power locally or nationally?
Yeah, here.
In here. In many ways, it's kind of quite hard to do what we would like to do on a local level, but we'd be asking for, we are asking for things like taking business rates back for our own, because at the moment when a business pays business rates, it goes to central government and we get a small proportion of that back.
Yeah, well, that's more, I mean, that's central government stuff, really. I mean, you'd have to twist their arm. We've given the same pot that we've got, this 350 million quid or so of our money that you guys have got up at City Hall, we've got to call it now, haven't we? Where there's obviously some newspapers call it other things, don't they? They don't necessarily use the word city to describe it. But where would the Greens, what would be the priorities that you'd be spending that on that George doesn't have?
Well, one of the problems with the budget that we currently have is it is not enough. There's no two ways about it. It is not enough.
So
to cover
what I'm saying is, what would you not cut that George is cutting? How's that for a question?
Well, at the moment, the budget that's coming hasn't been completely set and ratified anyway. But what we are doing is pushing for more money for children's centres, as well as there's a council tax reduction scheme that was paid for essentially and is now being cut. That's something that we are pushing to be retained, because that protects the most vulnerable people.
Well, if people can't afford to pay it, say for example they haven't got a job or they just don't have any money, or maybe they've got a massive debt on their credit card or elsewhere, why should they be expected? How have we arrived at this situation where everybody effectively is being asked to pay roughly the same amount for council tax? It does depend a bit on, you know, how big the property is, I believe, but including people who've got no money. That just doesn't seem to make sense.
Well,
to
I mean, council tax is a regressive tax anyway. It's based on outdated valuations of houses, where if you don't even own it, if you're renting it, it's not a progressive tax. So ideally we wouldn't have council tax, we'd taxation in a different way. But by protecting those with the least money with the council tax reduction scheme, you can sort of mitigate that a little bit. That's being cut back by central government, so we would aim to protect that. We'd also aim to look at a few things around protecting adult services, protecting children's services, protecting all of those sorts of things. And on a national level, if we had the opportunity, we would be looking at bringing in the universal basic income, which means that everybody universally, regardless, not means tested, would have enough money to live a basic life without fear of starvation.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because
eviction.
I thought Social Security meant that everybody had a kind of guaranteed basic standard of, you know, being able to have a roof over their head, effectively, something to eat, mm-hmm. some water to drink, not necessarily beer, or something stronger. That seems to have gone out of the window over the last 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Thanks to the start in Thatcher's government, and it hasn't been curtailed. It's the coalition stepped it up a little bit more, and now the current central government is basically free to continue that. And it's not, and it should be an insurance. It's the national insurance payment that we all make as an insurance policy, but that's not how it's being administered anymore.
Well, that's right. It's echoes of the floods, isn't it, in a way? These poor people that are paid, you know, paid money for insurance if they can get it, and then they often find, well, the insurance says, oh, sorry, you're not covered. Then mm-hmm. they have to go and take the insurers to court in order just to get the insurance people to pay out.
But worse than that, some of the flooding has actually been caused by central government policy. I don't know if you've read a piece by George Monbiot in The Guardian recently about the grouse farming and the grouse moors sort of above those flooded areas where... Some of these grouse moors were being investigated for illegal burning. Lovely green lush land that soaks in that water, the rainwater, has now been burnt off because you get a higher amount of grouse breeding, and therefore it makes more money for the people who then can pay more to come and shoot. And now central government is actually paying those grouse moor owners money, EU funding, farmland subsidy, to actually carry on doing this burning, which destroys the moorland, bad for the environment and terrible for those towns further downstream, because the grouse moors aren't able to absorb that moisture anymore, so it just flows straight down the river and into the towns.
I noticed up in Yorkshire anyway, it was also to do with dredging. They were saying mm-hmm. that 6 or 7 years ago, just like here in the Somerset Levels, they stopped dredging the rivers. Well, that means you've only got a quarter or a third of the actual volume mm-hmm. of water that can go down the river.
And straightening up rivers as well, so that it can just flow straight down without anything to slow down the flow of that water.
Martin, what do you make of all this, the floods we've had over the holidays? They've been absolutely horrendous, haven't they?
Well, I read the piece by George Monbiot that's just been mentioned, and I think that made a lot of sense to me. And the grouse moors, of course, are counted as agricultural exactly. land, so they get EU subsidy mm-hmm. for running them as grouse moors. And, of course, what they want is they want them dry, and they want drain them. Mm-hmm. They're digging drainage ditches. And I understand, as in the article he was saying, mm-hmm. one place they were even saying that the government were trying to stop them digging drainage ditches, that it was really inappropriate. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't do it. And then it turned out they're getting a government grant
yes.
to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this why do we need grouse moors? I mean, and why are they regarded as an agricultural use? They're not an agricultural use. That's an industrial use. And it shouldn't be subsidised in any way, shape or form, to my mind.
I mean, I was down at Slimbridge over the holidays and was listening to a fascinating talk by, and I would, if people haven't been there, I definitely would guarantee you'll have a good day out there, especially if you take the kids.
Mm.
This is where a lot of birds come to spend the winter. It's where Peter Scott, from years ago, who was a pioneer, really, of the, I think it's the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust.
Mm.
And one of the talks there was talking about this whole business of lead shot.
Mm-hmm.
Where almost every other country in Europe has banned lead shot because, of course, it's poisonous. It gets into the animals if they get shot and then they get away. But it's also in the environment. And then the birds eat this, mm-hmm. including grouse and things like that, and it gets inside them. It poisons them. It then poisons mm-hmm. the people who are eating the game birds as well.
Yeah.
And the government last year was going to announce that they were changing the rules and changing advice about mm-hmm. whether to eat the game birds or not, and then at the last minute they didn't release the guidance, obviously under pressure from the shooting
mm-hmm.
lobby.
Yeah.
Now it would be quite easy to put steel shot in these pellets and that wouldn't poison the animals, and it wouldn't poison people, and it wouldn't poison the environment so much. I guess that eventually it would just rust away. So it just shows you how this country works. And I wonder whether maybe some of the people who do the shooting that eat these birds have got lead poisoning.
And personally, I prefer a situation where we weren't shooting animals for fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's profit and fun. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Well, it's not even profit, because, of course, the fact is it's subsidised as an EU agricultural activity.
Good point. Very good
That's
point.
Absurd.
Yes.
To my mind, I mean, if we are going to have people shooting animals for fun, and I don't like the idea either, but if we're going to have it, there's absolutely no justification for subsidising it as an agricultural activity.
So
it isn't
subsidising cruelty to animals.
Yeah.
Amazing, isn't it? Really, what the landed gentry still get away with.
Well, indeed, and then of course, it makes no sense at all. Downstream, the damage caused by this is enormous,
and our taxes go to pay for it. Absolutely unbelievable. I mean, we're almost getting to the territory of the Queen and Prince Charles, and how much money they have, and yet they still insist on having money to look after their palaces and things like that. Anyway, look, let's come back to home a little bit more, because there's been this debacle over the last couple of weeks. Over the Malcolm X Centre and the St Paul's Carnival, which is obviously in St Paul's, which is Ashley Ward, which is green territory in the city, Annie. So what's going on here? First of all, we had the funding pulled from the St Paul's Carnival Committee and being told by the Arts Council and by George Ferguson, saying we don't think you're up to the job, with the police getting involved as well, saying, oh, they're just not good enough. And then the same sort of thing happening with the Malcolm X Centre. People being served with an eviction notice. I noticed the BBC headline changed. It started off saying something about the people being evicted from the Malcolm X Centre, and then the headline sort of changed into something a little bit less confrontational sounding, even though that's effectively what's happening at the end of February, Malcolm X people being evicted for having some sort of slight problem with a lease, somebody there that you know, if you go into the fine print, that they shouldn't have been there. And rather than talking to the Malcolm X about sorting this out, they've just said, right, we're going to evict you. So anyway, what's your take on this?
Well, first thing to say, it's not on my ward, or my neighbourhood partnership, so I don't have all the details on it. But what I do know is that the groups that use the Malcolm X are not being evicted. What's happening is the management company that sort of administrate the building are being... Their right to manage the building has been taken away, and an interim organisation, I think, will be managing it, and then the council working to find a better long-term solution. I don't know the ins and outs of it. I don't know the rights and fairnesses of it.
Well, they're replacing the people who are running it, aren't they? And they're not giving any particularly good reason for it either. They're saying, no, you guys have got to go because of some small print in the lease, and we've got some... potentially, anyway, I imagine they've got some other people that they have decided that they would rather prefer to run it. Now, that surely should be a decision for St Paul's. It shouldn't really be a decision for George Ferguson, especially with both of these issues, since we're dealing here with a former merchant venturer, someone who was, you know, part of this society, was part of the slave trade. This is almost like a red rag to a bull, surely, just telling the Afro-Caribbean community, particularly in St Paul's, no, we don't like the way you're running things, we're taking over.
Well, the thing is that I don't think it's actually been George Ferguson's decision. I think it's been a council officer decision. And it's also, it's not something that's just happening in the Malcolm X Centre. There's the dance centre in my own ward on Jacobs Wells Road. They're having the same situation. They're being evicted because the council officers aren't satisfied with the way in which they're running the building. And I know there's quite a few examples across the city.
Well, I don't think anyone would mind, Annie, if people were being told that they've done this, which is dreadful, disastrous. Say, for example, that they've misspent money or that they've pocketed it themselves, they've done something which is really outrageous. But actually, I mean, surely the whole purpose and the point of community centres is that they're largely, they're close to the community, that they're not centrally managed by George Ferguson. And whatever you say about he hasn't, but this isn't his decision, it's an officer's decision, I'm sure he could have changed it. I mean, he's got these dictatorial powers we keep hearing about.
Yeah, I don't know what sway he's had of it, and I'm not going to defend him either way about it. But what I do know is that the centre itself isn't closing. The refugee rights group that uses the centre will still be using it. That won't be affected. Probably from some of the negative press, some people may not have placed bookings that they might have otherwise. So there will be a little bit of an issue around there. But the centre will still be operating, and that won't be taken away. And what we actually need is for, obviously we've had a lot of cuts across the city, as we've already discussed, we need more money and more support to be put into St. Paul's and other areas.
So why spend money on legal action against, you know, seems like a waste of money. Anyhow, look, if anybody out there has got things to say about this, it'd be really interesting to hear from you. We'll obviously be covering this over future weeks as we run up to this potential eviction of the management committee from the Malcolm X Centre. And do contact me. You can get hold of me through the radio station here or on Facebook or Twitter. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. We'll do what we can to make sure your views are represented. And I think what we'll probably be doing nearer the time is having both sides, you know, getting someone from the City Council. Yeah, I already actually asked George Ferguson if he could come here and discuss it, and he said he didn't think there was anything.
But I know that, both Gus Hoyt and Rob Telford, who are the two local councillors, are working very closely with the Malcolm X and doing what they can to sort of make this better. If there's a way through it, they'll find it and make sure that it's the best outcome for St. Paul's.
Well, let's hope so. Anyway, come on, Rob. You can do it. And let's go back now to talk a bit about the floods. And this time back to Wednesday to Prime Minister's Questions, where Jeremy Corbyn and David Cameron locked horns, rather, about particularly about the floods in York.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister hasn't answered on Leeds, he hasn't answered on Cumbria, he hasn't answered on the warning from Professor Mellors. Like him, last week I met people in York who had been affected by flooding, and I met a young couple, Chris and Victoria, whose home had been flooded over Christmas. It wasn't very funny for them. This young couple lost many of their possessions. Photos, children, toys, schoolwork, and they've got the foul stench of flood water in their homes, as many families have all over this country. They are asking all of us wholly legitimate questions. Why was it that the insufficient pump capacity of the Foss Barrier, again alerted to in 2013 by a government report, was not dealt with and those pumps were not upgraded? Thus, people were flooded in York and their possessions and homes severely damaged. Those people want answers from all of us, and in particular from the Prime Minister.
I have the greatest sympathy with anyone that's been flooded, and we have to do what it takes to get people and get to communities back on their feet, and that is why we put record sums in more quickly to help communities in Cumbria, in Lancashire, and now in Yorkshire, and we'll continue to do that. Specifically on the question of the Foss pumps, that was about to be tendered for extra investment, and that investment will now go ahead because the money is there. So what I'd say to him, we're putting in the money, we're putting it in more quickly, the military got involved more quickly, and to that couple who got flooded, we're also doing something that previous governments have talked about but never achieved, which is to have an insurance scheme so every single household in our country can get insured. Flood Re. Now, that's not been done before. So have lessons been learnt? Yes, they have. Are there more lessons to learn? There always are. But frankly, we don't need a lecture from Malta from the Honourable Gentleman.
I don't quite understand what the lecture from Malta's about. Where did that come in? Well, I mean, what tends to happen in these kind of events is everybody starts pointing fingers at everybody else for not doing the right thing. I think what we were discussing earlier in this programme about the use of the Yorkshire moors is absolutely crucial. What we're doing is we're not taking account of watersheds which have been there for thousands of years, and we are basically ignoring the lessons of history. I mean, we're still building, private developers are still building on floodplains all over Britain, which is absolutely bonkers. They're bound to flood, and then we're surprised when they do.
When it comes to the Foss Barrier, I took a special interest in that, because the way the story changed over a few days, first of all, they said, well, we're very sorry, we've had to raise this barrier because the pumps might get flooded. And then the next day, the story had changed to, there was a problem with the pumps, and so we had to raise the Foss Barrier anyway. And actually, it meant 600 people in York got flooded. Now, he mentioned it there, and he's saying, oh, well, there was some sort of problem with with maintenance of the... Well, this is obviously what's going on here is that there isn't enough money being spent actually keeping the flood defences up to scratch. And as a result, they've had to flood 600 homes in York, which wouldn't necessarily have had to be flooded at all.
Well, that's because we're supposed to be bringing the deficit down, because that's what economic policy has come down to. In actual fact, what we should be doing is investing for the future in things like flood control. And we should that should be the way in which we go forward. And then we think about what resources we need to do that. The whole thrust of economic policy by the government has been, how can we spend the least money, because we've got to save money because the banks were crashed and we bailed them out, and we've got to somehow carry on down this road. The fundamental problem is the economic policy of the government, which means that infrastructure like flood defences are not being invested in. But also there's a fundamental problem of mentality about the way we operate. So the grouse moors are being subsidised to cause flooding further downstream. Maybe we just got to get rid of grouse moors. Sounds radical. Not that radical, really.
What about...
I'm fine with that.
What about around here, Annie? Are we safe from... I mean, I don't want to be alarmist. I hate the media when they get so alarmist, but a tsunami down the Avon Gorge, you know, something... flooding has happened here in the past. Just by Sunny's in St Werburgh's, I remember going past there. You can see right up on the top story of one of the houses. This is where the flood levels came to. Are we safe here?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we are vulnerable, and of course it plays into, it's part of a bigger picture, which is the one of climate change. So we've recently had COP21 in Paris, where obviously George Ferguson was over there, and we had David Cameron and all the politicians saying support for reducing climate change and world temperatures, and yet at the same time cutting renewable energy subsidies and cutting the ability for people to go down the renewable energy route, which is something that's actually crucial. If we are, it's not just the subsidising of grouse moors and destroying our environment for capitalist gain, but it's also refusing to use renewable or curtailing access to renewable energy.
You mean wind power, that sort of
wind power? Wind power, solar power, water power, hydropower. Those are things that would have a dramatic effect on the carbon production and therefore climate change and temperature change. But, of course, you can't monetarise the sun, so there's no shareholder value in half the country or the whole country being solar powered. And for if we all have solar powers on panels on our roofs, then in which way we wouldn't have to pay electricity bills in the same way which we would anymore.
Right, we wouldn't be so dependent on Babylon, would we?
No,
and on cash money all the time. I think that, you know, there's a lot to be said actually for people that say, well, actually they're trying to get us to pay for everything as much as possible that the earth
water
actually gives
included.
Us for free. You know, water, all these things are free.
If they could put air in big containers and make us pay for it, they would love to do it.
Have they?
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
yeah. With the smog that they've had in China recently, there's bottles of air that you can buy for huge amounts of money.
Mm. Now, doesn't that say, well, actually, if we want to increase GDP, we need to have permanent smog and start selling air?
Yeah.
I mean, that's scary, isn't it? If you actually think about what's happened with the floods as well, massive increase in GDP with all that extra spend on all the insurance. So maybe it was a good idea to not to dredge the Foss and these other rivers. Scary world we're moving into, Martin. And Martin, as Martin says several times on this show in the past, that there's actually quite big incentives internationally for disasters to happen, like where there's a total failure in a grain harvest and suddenly the price of grain goes up. Well, people can actually speculate and bet on that. So if you know, potentially a criminal gang, and I shouldn't be giving them any ideas here, if they were to sabotage some kind of crop, they could make a fortune out of the increase in prices.
Well, this is what you're referring to, I think, is Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism. Mm. And, of course, they do batten on to disasters as a means of fulfilling things that wouldn't otherwise be possible. And they even actually create such disasters. If you think about wars and so on, these are conscious decisions. They're not just things that happen and then they're responding. They're actually going out there and making the chaos so that they can then achieve the goals that they want to achieve.
Well, on Wednesday, I interviewed a chap called Nick Much. He's a freelance journalist, and he's been looking into the Bullingdon Club. And he's very, very worried that we're actually going back to a kind of Victorian Britain, not just through some of the values that they were in those days of workhouses and things like that, but actually through the way that people get to power, not through democracy, but through mm-hmm. clubs like the Bullingdon. And he's pointed out, for example, that there's been very little coverage of the Bullingdon Club in the Daily Mail, which was the paper that originally published the pictures of Cameron and George Osborne and Boris Johnson in the Bullingdon Club mm. in their these penguin outfits of theirs mm. that cost, I think, £3,500 each, those. But Vere Harmsworth, mm. who's the son of the owner of the Daily Mail, is now in the Bullingdon Club. So perhaps that's why the Mail has reined back its coverage. Worth mentioning also that Jacob Rothschild from the banking family and David Dimbleby, who chairs BBC Question Time every mm. week, a former Bullingdon Club member. So let's have a little listen now to an excerpt from this. And if you want to hear the full interview, you can hear it on our Dialect show, which has been pulled from BCFM, hopefully be back soon, but that's on dialectradio.co.uk, and you can download that as a podcast. But here's an excerpt now from my interview with Nick Much.
One of the things that I don't think often realised is how much influence the club used to have in the 19th century and how much influence it's actually had over time. Thistle Rhodes is by no means the only significant figure. For instance, from the 19th century, at least one Prime Minister, Archibald Primrose, the Earl of Rosebery, was a member. Randolph Churchill, who is Winston Churchill's father and was with the Exchequer, he was a member. Cecil Rhodes was a member in 1877. And what I think this shows is that this sort of club has almost been a kind of a finishing school for a lot of Britain's elite for quite some time. One other document I managed to get hold of, for instance, was a full club membership list between 1850 and 1899. Now, there's at least 100 peers in that, at least 50 members of the House of Commons. The post of First Lord of the Admiralty, I managed to identify 5 people in that list who were in that post. The Prime Minister, Chancellor, a couple of foreign secretaries. And one thing that I think this shows is that it's quite how much things haven't changed since the 19th century. In the 19th century, all these powerful people went through the club, and now all these powerful people are still going through the club again, or all this kind of time later. It's a little bit like the 21st century is mirroring the class system of the 19th century, or at least it might be emerging that way.
Well, these kind of clubs exist in all elite universities. So you've got the Skull and Bones societies in Yale and Harvard and so on. Bullingdon Club is our version of it. And they are part of the networking that's carried out within the ruling class, if you like. I mean, Skull and Bones, I understand that they have to lie in a coffin and swear to various things. And it sounds bizarre, but all of these things are part of joining an inner group who will then later on run the country. Well, so John Kerry's a member of Skull and Bones, and Bush. And of course, Kerry actually beat Bush in the election, but he, as a member of Skull and Bones, threw the election. He should have actually said Bush didn't win the 2003 election, but he didn't. And of course, he then gets the reward of being the vice president for Obama later on. And all of these kind of, the thing about the Bullingdon Club in Britain, though, is it's very much conservative territory. Skull and Bones covers virtually the whole spectrum of political forces, mainstream political forces in the US. Bullingdon Club, historically, very much, basically, you've got to go to Eton and Oxford to be in the Bullingdon Club.
Well, one of the other
I went to Oxford, but I didn't go to Eton. Oh, you were. So nobody would ever have asked me to join the Bullingdon Club, not that I would ever have wanted to join it. But these things exist. What's amazing to me is that we have got an old Etonian government in Britain, like we had throughout the 19th and 18th centuries. And the system, with first past the post and all the rest of it, is simply not fit for purpose. It's long ago become an anachronism. And on a minority of the vote, the Conservative government, run by ex-Eton, ex-Oxford people, are running the country as they did throughout most of
and
the British
Benny,
Empire.
One of the things that Nick pointed out in that interview to me was that actually the headmasters of Eton, are almost many of them are also bulleted club members. So it's almost like recycling its own system. Even he's talking there about Cecil Rhodes, 100 lords, 50 MPs, the military and the banking elite. It doesn't seem like a lot of has changed since Victorian times even.
We like to think of ourselves as this great pinnacle of democracy in this country, but in actual fact, our democratic system is broken. It's not really that democratic at all in terms of the resulting government from a vote, in terms of who got what amount of the vote share, before you even get into who those politicians are in the first place. It's not democratic, it's not representative of the country.
On to another story, and Tatler Tories Freemason cronies Mark Clark goes to the same lodge as councillor who formerly worked for a law firm. It chooses to conduct inquiry into the bully scandal in the Tory party. Well, it's not just a bully scandal, it's also a sexual blackmail scandal. Martin, this is pretty worrying, isn't it? They've asked somebody to look into this inquiry at the top of the Tory party who's in the same Masonic lodge, at least he's formerly worked for the same law firm, someone in the same Masonic lodge as the guy who's being accused of this, and actually of course somebody committed suicide as a result of it.
Well, obviously it's hard to comment on cases which are ongoing, because the allegations are made and they may or may not be true, but I think we're in this case, as in the previous case, we're talking about elite groups like Propaganda Duo in Italy, which was the Freemasons Lodge at the heart of government, which was definitely behind most of the terrorism in Italy in the 70s and 80s, according to the Italian police force. Not many people in Britain know this, but the head of the Italian Supreme Court in Posimato has written a book about it. It's absolutely clear NATO intelligence services working through a Freemason Lodge, P2, were behind the Bologna bombing and various other things in Italy in the 70s, 80s and 90s. But most people in this country are blithely unaware of the sinister background to all of these kind of organisations.
Annie, I wonder what you make of this. We've also heard this week government ministers are accused of avoiding scrutiny by dodging the toughest TV and radio interviews. Well, actually Mark Weston didn't turn up. He was the leader of the Conservatives at the end of last year for his interview here. I think it was actually to do with he had a cold. I hope it was anyway. But it does seem that a lot of the top Conservatives and even Secretaries of State and ministers are being accused of governing in the shadows, because they regularly just refuse to come on and talk about. It says one of this is from the Huffington Post. For 12 weekdays in the last month, no minister appeared on any of the BBC's flagship daily politics programmes. That is the Radio 4's Today, The World at One, The Daily Politics on BBC Two. Only 18 ministerial appearances in total were made on these daily weekly shows from November to roughly the same time in December. Now, this is a massive fall from what's usual. I mean, quite often, whenever there's a problem in a ministerial area, a government minister should appear, but apparently they're not.
One of the things I have noticed since being a councillor is the silence from the Conservative group when they know that public opinion is not necessarily in line with what they would actually
say.
So
locally or nationally?
Both. Obviously, I notice it quite acutely locally. But yes, I'd say silence does speak volumes quite often.
Martin, the government counters that it engages in a media blitz during major events, with ministers appearing on every show from the Today programme in the early morning to Newsnight at 10:30. But it's only on the stories that they want to tell. I mean, for example, we had an announcement, I think it was on Tuesday this week, about housing, a big announcement about housing. I was listening to Radio 5. They just basically gave the minister his opportunity to say what he wanted to say without any questions at all about, I mean, he's saying we're going to be building lots of affordable housing, and the fact that we've got nearly 700,000 houses unbuilt with planning permission still sitting there that haven't been built, and that they're not selling. Basically, that's what's happening, is houses are being built but they're not selling because they're far too expensive for most people to afford. That question wasn't even put to him.
Well, what's happened with the BBC is that they've been under attack by various Tory governments over the decades, and they've just become frit, basically. They do not want to ask those difficult questions because they know that the minister won't come on next time, and in any case, they've got the purse strings of the BBC. Indirectly, they can put pressure on them, and they do. Mm. And what tends to happen is the BBC used to be somewhere pretty much in the dead centre, as it were, of political judgment, but they now run scared of the Tory press. The Tory press decide what the stories are.
It's a good, really good example.
And then the BBC runs with that.
A good example from Newsnight last night. They had a big discussion about Osborne's announcement this week. He's saying, I think there may be a few problems with the economy. The day after, of course, David Cameron said, we've got a super strong, healthy economy. That's why we can spend so much on flood defences on the Wednesday. On the Thursday, George Osborne is saying, we may have some problems with China, particularly with China. And when they came to discussing it on Newsnight, the Labour view simply is not there. No Steve Keane, no John McDonnell, nothing, not even mention of people's QE or anything like that.
No, well, I mean, we know, I mean, capitalist society is unfair and unfairly organised. Access to resources of all kinds are not evenly distributed. And that includes media resources, controlling the narrative. The debate comes, how can we reduce the deficit? Now, I'm not against reducing deficits, but it's not what economic policy is about. Economic policy is about getting a balance between various conflicting objectives, and reducing a deficit is only one of them. And yet that is completely missing from the mainstream debate. And it's very difficult to educate people. We obviously do our best on this show to raise the level of discussion. But a lot of mainstream media are run by either the advertisers, owners, or the BBC, heavy manners from the government.
It seems to be, yes, quite a lot of clampdown and concentration of ownership of the media. Annie, we've heard also that Jeremy Corbyn is calling for an annual TV debate, and he's been backed by Sky News, so he wants to go head-to-head with David Cameron on TV. The Conservatives have said it's got a... I think it's the Independent this was in. Nigel Morris, Deputy Political Editor, has said that the suggestion has received a chilly response from Tory sources.
Well, as we said, the Conservatives aren't exactly... it did feel like David Cameron did everything he could to get out of doing the debates pre-election, so it doesn't really surprise me that he's not particularly warmly responding to this.
Well, the SNP, the leader Nicola Sturgeon, and the Lib Dems Tim Farron said they would sign up if the Prime Minister accepted the challenge. Natalie Bennett, Green Party leader, and Leanne Wood of Plaid Cymru also would be expected to follow suit.
Martin, I expect we would do.
This is the sort of thing you would expect, isn't it, in a media age, that the Prime Minister is prepared to go head-to-head with people other than just before the general election?
Well, I mean, Linton Crosby, who's supposedly the mastermind of their crushing election victory, although it wasn't such a thing, his policy is that we don't take any notice. If we decide it's not in our interests to participate in a debate, we just don't.
What you're saying there is, effectively, they're happy to go up against Sky and Rupert Murdoch and possibly Newsnight, but they're not happy about going up against their opponents, Annie. Isn't that what they're saying?
Yes, well, I mean, if you look back to the 2010 election, David Cameron didn't do very well on any of those debates. So, of course...
Yeah, he won the election, though, didn't he? No, he didn't really.
What they thought is having Nick Clegg on the same platform as the two major parties undermined their position. And of course, you've mentioned there the SNP and Plaid Cymru. If the Prime Minister had to sit there as one of a group of five party leaders, that from a Tory point of view reduces him from being, you know, the man above it all. And that's their thinking. Yep. We don't want to be seen to be on the same level as these minor parties, inverted commas.
Yeah, well, they think that they're better than everybody.
Well, the whole system and the history of the Tory party as the natural party of government throughout hundreds of years.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it does seem more and more to me that when you get somebody in power as a government minister or as a prime minister or whatever, once they get to the top there, actually, effectively, they are the person you hear on the news every morning giving announcements. And there's not very much criticism, actually, or certainly constructive criticism, friendly criticism, or even the other points of view from journalists, and even quite often they don't allow the other side to talk at the same time. So what you're effectively getting is, I'm electing the person I want to hear announcements from the next 5 years.
But it's not just prime ministerial government. There's always been an issue of prime ministerial government, you know, that it's also to do with politics. Tory prime ministers in particular. Gordon Brown didn't get that kind of kid gloves treatment. The people like Alistair Campbell, twisting arms behind the scenes, forced the media to take the new Labour project seriously, but it wasn't a natural thing. The Tories naturally expect deference.
Yet they believe that being in charge is their birthright.
That's right.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it?
Well, I mean, Cameron said, when he was asked, why do you want to be Prime Minister when he was younger, he said, I thought I'd be rather good at it. And that just about sums
well,
up
where... Well, it's funny.
But then also quite a lot of people vote Conservative because they think it's the right thing to do, but without ever really questioning why that is.
I saw one of the Newsnight editors saying exactly that. I'm just rather good at this journalism lark. You know, this kind of attitude is a little bit irritating.
There's a massive sense of entitlement there. Mm-hmm. And you've got a similar problem in the Labour Party now with some of the people there from the new Labour era. They've got a massive sense of entitlement as well.
Okay.
And they're very unhappy
talking about entitlement, feeling that they're being
squeezed aside.
Never mind North Korea, an obscure law allows Prince Charles to legally set off a nuclear bomb. This was one of the most, I found quite interesting stories over there. The title of Duke of Cornwall excludes the prince from punishment from a number of laws, including the Data Protection Act and the Wildlife and Countryside Act. And title of Duke of Cornwall, he gets better legal protection over his properties than other landowners too. This is partly the same sort of story, isn't it? What's happening is, well, as these laws are going through, Prince Charles says, I want to have a look at that, please, and then he just changes it before it gets signed off by his mum.
Mm-hmm. Well, there seems to be quite a lot of things like that, and through Freedom of Information, I think there's been quite a lot of examples of him meddling in different laws, which is, again, a flaw of our so-called democracy.
He's also been getting cabinet minutes, Martin. We heard that at the end of last year, that even ministers don't get.
We didn't even know about this, which is extraordinary. But everybody in the know must have known for years and years and years. The people who run the country know that this was what goes on.
We're still living in a feudal system, folks.
Well, we are. We've basically, democracy in this country is a very late and very weak development. Yeah. But you've got a state which has pre-existed any kind of democracy in this country and still exists, not necessarily in contradiction, but certainly in a separate realm from the democratic process.
Yeah. And so many people automatically accept that makes perfect sense that he should have this information. Why not? He's going to be king. Why shouldn't it?
I would make the point, if that's the case, why didn't we know that this was going on? Why was it secret?
Exactly. But people,
he's excluded from the Freedom of Information Act. How handy is that? Mm. Anyway, look, meanwhile, back in the real world, and back at Prime Minister's Questions, housing is one of the biggest problems in this country, where we all having to pay far too much for our housing, and no proper new houses, at least affordable ones, are being built. We're in the middle of a massive housing bubble, and young couples have got real serious problems actually affording to buy. As I said earlier on, something like 700,000 homes aren't actually being built because the house builders know they won't sell. So anyway, this came up on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions.
I've effort.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With home ownership down to its lowest level in a generation, down every year since he became Prime Minister, why did Tory MPs vote against Labour's amendment to the housing bill last night, which would have protected the publicly funded discount for new starter homes for future buyers? Isn't that better value for money for first-time buyers and for the taxpayer, yes or no?
Well, the proposal for starter homes is a Conservative Party proposal put into our manifesto, opposed throughout by the Labour Party. This is only happening because we won a majority and put a housing bill through this House of Commons. We are taking every step we can to help more people get on the housing ladder. So in London, where he represents, we're seeing Help to Buy now funding 40% of the home people want to buy rather than 20%. We're going to see 200,000 starter homes built during this Parliament.
moment. Because we're managing our economy properly, interest rates are low, so it's now easier for people to get a mortgage. And with our Help to Save scheme, there's now every opportunity for people to put aside money to help them with their deposit. We are absolutely on the side of the homeowner, but above all, those people who want to get on the housing ladder. We're helping with jobs, helping with tax cuts, helping with Help to Buy, helping with Help to Save, and crucially, helping by building more homes. Yeah.
This is a subject quite close to my heart. I rent and I have a young family. I know firsthand how hard and impossible it is to get a mortgage, because there's more and more hoops to jump through. When I try to get a mortgage, I had to account for every single little thing, down to whether or not I went out for coffee ever in the week, how many times I bought a sandwich for lunch, how much I spent on childcare for my child, whether or not I took him to soft play.
That's a bit naughty, isn't it? Because yeah, they're using your need for a home to grab all your personal information.
Exactly. And the thing is that tightening up the mortgage regulation to such a degree that then it's impossible, because then also there are more and more short-term contracts, people who only have one-year contracts, which maybe keep rolling, but mortgage companies then won't see that as a secure person to lend on. All of those things, and affordable, this idea of affordable housing being 80% of the market value, when the market value is, you know, 10 times what someone's salary is, when you can get perhaps 4 times your salary if you're lucky, is not affordable by anyone's stretch of the imagination. And if they actually cared about creating homes for people, they'd be building more social homes, and that's what we need, rather than selling off social homes and forcing councils and housing associations to sell off their accommodation and removing that safety net. They're causing people to get into a trap of either being privately rented or into a mortgage trap that they can't afford, rather than actually providing the social homes that they have a duty to provide.
In short, it's a racket.
It is a racket.
It's very much a racket, and if you think about this so-called affordable homes, this is very much like the subprime mortgages in the United States, which eventually led to the crash that we all know and love. And of course, the real problem with British
Martin, it's a bailout, it wasn't a crash.
Well, all right, but we could argue about it. The GDP all over the world was severely hit, let's put it that way. It wasn't as big a crash as it might have been because the state stepped in, but that's a diversion. The real problem in Britain has always been the obsession with home ownership. In the 1920s, the Conservative governments realised that the threat of Bolshevism, what they needed to do was encourage private ownership of housing. So the tax system and everything else has been geared to get people into buying their own homes, inverted commas. In large parts of Northern Europe, people, even wealthy people, don't buy houses. They don't. No. They spend their money on other things. So when German upper middle class people get together at a dinner party, they don't talk about their house prices.
Also,
they talk about their business.
There's also a basic fact that you're paying,
different culture.
You're paying for a house far, far more than it costs the people to actually build it. You're paying large amounts for the sort of speculative value of the land.
The speculative value of the land is what this is all about. There is what I call an inflationist block in the southeast of England, which makes money out of housing bubbles and busts.
Yeah. Talking about
and that's what keeps them in beer money.
Hang on, Annie. I'll let you have the last word on this, Annie.
I was just going to say as well that these starter homes, we need good quality, decent sizes of homes. When you're talking about homes for young families and you've got double bedrooms where you can barely fit a double bed in and nothing else, that's not what we should be building either. It's. I agree with you. It is a racket. It is a trap to get people invested in having to. You can't challenge the status quo when you're so tied up with just being able to make your mortgage repayments.
Let's put it this way: if you were a minor and you live in a council house, you've got a position to go on strike.
Yeah.
If you're buying that house, so easy.
Exactly, and that's how Thatcher broke the strikes.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely.
And it's taking away people's power. Yeah,
43% of the population lived in council accommodation, and now it's a factor. You can't even, it's really hard to even get on the register.
Anyway, folks, while we're talking about housing and value of land, I'd like to go to another interview I did for Dialect this week. That's on dialectradio.co.uk, and that was with Steve Norman from the Avonmouth Action Group. Now, George Ferguson sold off the port for £10 million last year. Steve Norman, who's a merchant seaman and he's lived in Avonmouth most of his life, he's now in Shirehampton, he reckons it could be worth about 100 times that. So let's have a look, have a listen now to Steve.
Well, it's now a private company, Bristol Port Company, owned by two merchant venturers, David Ord and Terence Morton. They have total control, and as you, a lot of people may know, that our esteemed Mayor Ferguson recently gave them the freehold for £10 million. He basically gave them a lottery ticket.
Why do you say a lottery ticket? Is it? I mean, surely it's a bit of a liability, the port, at the moment, because a lot of ships it can't take, and also it's a lot of maintenance, isn't it? A lot of money needs to be spent on it, too.
I disagree with the statement. They've got plans, future expansion plans. When you consider it's not just the port they own, they own a lot of surrounding land, 2,300 and something acres of land, and pockets of land in Avonmouth. It's up the Cabot Park have been selling for 8, 9, 10 million just for one pocket. They were given a lottery ticket. And then consider the other aspect, that they're going to build a deep water terminal out in the estuary that'll be for containers, and that, you know, that's already in place. That's a joint venture with the Chinese, and that may well explain why our esteemed mayor has been spending a lot of time in a certain place in China. I know a lot of Chinese have been seen on the port over the recent years, and you know it's rumoured to be it's going to be a joint venture. So if you look at the value of the port then, it would be astronomical. You'd be looking probably £800-900 million it'd be worth.
Well, that's a bit of a bargain from us, from the Bristol City Council, from the public. £10 million is a bit of a bargain if it's worth nearly a billion. And he was saying also to me, Steve, that some of the parcels of land, just a couple of acres, has sold for £1 million. They've got 2,000 acres down there. This just seems like an absolutely diabolical deal. And obviously, it's a merchant venturer, ex-merchant venturer, if you use the word ex, mayor, selling it off to a couple of his merchant venturer mates.
Yeah, we, as a Green Party, we did oppose the port sell-off. It's short-sighted. And as with quite a lot of the sell-offs of various council assets, I think they have been quite short-sighted. Short financial gain, but long-term would have been good assets. I mean, quite a lot of the property that the council has sold off within the city could have been converted into homes, for example.
Well, it's very similar to what's happened in Greece, where they say, right, you've got no money. So imagine that Bristol City Council is Greece. You've got no money. You want to keep your services going for your vulnerable people. Right, give us your assets. You need the money now, don't you? And so, therefore, the whole austerity agenda leads to fire sale privatisation, which means that the sharks can come in and take pretty valuable assets for much less than they're worth, because it's a short run. We've got to have some money to keep our social services running, and that's a cheap option. The election's in 2 years' time. You know, the port is some, you know, if we're going to keep the port in the hands of the council, that's, we're talking 20 or 30 years. And of course, we haven't got, you know, if there wasn't the pressure on austerity, they wouldn't have to do it.
Okay. So if you want to hear the full interview with Steve, great interviews, fantastic, very interesting guy. You can hear that at dialectradio.co.uk. We're hoping Dialect will be back on BCFM as soon as possible. Thanks. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to Councillor for Cabot Ward, leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council, Annie Stafford Townsend. After the news, Grenville Johnson and Fabian Breckles join us, both from Ronstone's area of St George, to pay tribute to the life and work of Councillor Ron Stone, who died unexpectedly while in the BRI for tests over the holiday. See you after the Murdoch News at 6.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.